This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the ball on the show.
I'm going to give two numbers to our next guest. Brock Hewitt is stepping in here. 112 and 13. What do you think those two numbers are? 112 and 13. And I'll give you a hint. They relate to Seattle's performance in divisional playoff games on the road under Pete Carroll. 112, 13.
That's a good question, Danny. I'm going to guess you have an article about this.
Not yet.
Not yet.
What is first half scoring differential for 1,000? 112 to 13. And with that, we start Blue 42.
Here we go. This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42.
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42. Blue 42.
Brock, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. How was the coach yesterday?
Coach was pretty good. He made me feel better. And then I went and looked up and saw that it was 112 to 13 that Seattle's been outscored in the first half.
Yes.
And I realized I watched that game five times before.
Yes.
Five times. Five times I've seen that game. Yeah. They get up big. They come roaring back. And everybody goes, oh, wait, we'll get them next year. And, well, they got them next year once.
Yeah.
They got them next year once, but they didn't get them next year and all those other times. So I'm wrestling with that. Paul says I'm in one of the seven stages of grief right now. It sounds like I'm in anger.
You're in anger? I like that you've just somehow gone from hope and acceptance to anger. It is reverse order, but I like it.
I heard from more than a couple people that Pete was maybe a little more emotional. Did you find him more emotional after this
one? Loved this team. Yeah. Yes, he loved this team. And I came away from it wondering, does Pete now see that the challenge is to get guys to believe as much as it is any of the football? Mm. Is that his challenge as a leader? Because he's certainly tied into that. And there's a story in the New York Times last week and one of the Seattle Times about the compete to create, I believe it is, the program that he's having Microsoft people and offering to different corporate clients. Like, getting guys to believe, and he did get this team to believe, and it took him to 11 wins, and that's probably more than this team, quote-unquote, should have won just based on all the statistical indicators.
Well, I think my small business owner friends would all tell you the same thing, that, yeah, getting this young group of people to truly believe in their work and in a work environment and a team environment is one of their great challenges, and much more challenging than it was 10, 20 years ago.
All right, Brock. Of the following three factors, which was most responsible for
this question
not
one?
Getting further? This is question one. Which of the following three factors was most responsible for Seattle not getting further this season? One, injuries. Two, talent. Three, scheme. You have to pick one of those three.
Oh, I saw this on a poll somewhere. Where did I see this?
I ran that up there on Twitter last night.
Where did I see this on a poll? Got pretty good traction, too. I mean, thousands of votes. And
4,100? What?
And overwhelmingly so, the answer, I believe, was injuries when I saw it. I think over 60% of the
60%?
Folks said injuries. Yeah.
So just bring them all back and it'll be fine because they won't get hurt next year.
Yeah, that's not the way the NFL works. Yeah, that's not how it's going to happen. I would say if I had to answer of those three, I think injuries played an enormous role. But sorry, so did it in Philly, and so will it over the next 2-3 weeks in the NFL. And the healthiest team that remains is more than likely the one that's going to lift the Lombardi Trophy. So, yeah, I think injuries played an enormous role, but that can't ever be an excuse nor even an explanation in the NFL because everybody deals with it, and everyone is going to deal with it. I will say this. They have to look at their defensive scheme. And when I heard Pete quoted, with you guys yesterday saying, oh, we liked a lot of those numbers, I'm going to continue to scratch my head, and maybe someday I'll have a cup of coffee with Coach and we can talk about what numbers they are seeing out of their base defense or out of his defense this year that he was most encouraged by, because I don't find too many of them.
That leads us right into question number two. Did you get the feeling yesterday that he's open to some changes on that front? Because in his press conference afterwards, he did say that he thought it was interesting that teams stopped running three wide receiver sets against that 4-3 defense. He also said that they are looking at everything. Can you see them finally adapting with the times and changing things defensively?
Yeah, I think most importantly, they've got to get more dudes on the bus. What I mean by that is you've got to just simply get much more talent. Danny, to your question there, I would probably say talent, right? If that was one of your three answers, it was injuries, it was talent, it was scheme. While injuries was the obvious answer, I think talent for me is you know, the way I would go with it. You need more talent defensively. You need more difference makers.
Specifically where?
Specifically at all three levels of their defense, specifically.
Wow.
You need more speed. We talked about this yesterday and the need for speed. You need more of it, right? You need, you know, how many does San Francisco have up front? 4, 5, 6 dudes that can all go and run. 2, 3 linebackers that can all go and run. You know, in the secondary, and they're beat up in their secondary, and they're not the end-all, be-all in their secondary because they can get picked on. And, I think we'll get picked on a little bit this week again. But, yeah, I think you have to add at all three levels a much more elite speed playmaking ability. And then once you get that in the door, then you start to evaluate some of this scheme. I mean, the other perplexing question I would have for Coach when we have a Coke is not only talking about base defense, is what happened with Ugo and Marquise Blair? Because both of those guys got twitch, both of them got some thump, and both of them got more speed than the guys that they went with and played at those positions this year. Why didn't you assimilate them more as you did in your first iteration and even in your second iteration playing young people? Why didn't those guys get more run? I would like much more specific answers than I have right now.
Marquise Blair being inactive for this game and the amount of Plano Hill that we saw in big-time spots where he often failed,
yeah,
that was most puzzling to me.
Yeah, I don't know if that was the ankle. I think for this one, there was at least he missed practice the last couple days at the end of the week, turned an ankle, I believe, on Wednesday last week. So I'm going to say maybe that played a role, that he wasn't the healthy scratch that LJ Collier was. But, you know, that again, an LJ Collier first-round pick that had very little twitch, that had very little influence, that made very little physical impact on this team, those kind of moves can't happen moving forward.
Question three, Brock. Pete mentioned opposing offenses getting the ball out laterally on them. The peripheral running game, the outside zone, said that they're going to make some changes. What does he mean?
Yeah, I think that's some of that speed that we just talked about right there, right? That KJ and had a wonderful year and, you know, is a tremendous leader and ton of tackles. But, you know, getting out on the edge versus him, getting out on the edge versus Cody, getting out on the edge, you know, with Bradley McDougald and Lano Hill and those safeties that, you know, run 4-7. It's just, yeah, you're going to give up some space. It's hard. It's hard to do that. So, you know, a little bit less nickel, too. You know, you didn't have some of that perimeter run the year before when you played nickel, what, 50, 60% of the time with Justin Coleman? It was pretty nasty setting that edge as that nickelback. Didn't really have that this year as he played so much of that base defense. So, yeah, there is a bunch of scheme, and I'll be curious, you know, what they do defensively. I was sitting there watching that championship game last night. And for all the conversation we constantly have about offense, and everybody's looking for that next young Joe Brady, right? This offensive mind. And where can I find this just genius offensive guy? Why don't we talk about that with defense? Why don't we talk about, you know, if I'm an NFL franchise, you know what I'm looking for? I'm looking for the youngest, sharpest, brightest defensive mind that has had to attack these college schemes that are starting to proliferate more in the NFL. I want that horsepower in my building. Everybody is so enthralled with, oh, give me the offensive wonder genius boy. And, you know, who's going to be the next creative guy? How about the guy defensively? How about a Dave Aranda down there at LSU? Why doesn't somebody in the NFL just pony up and pay that dude? I know he makes a couple million bucks at LSU, but that guy is, he's a different kind of smart. And he's proven that along the way and where he has been. And I mean, well, why don't defensive guys get framed in that way? And if I'm an NFL organization, yeah, I may be looking to try to find that next sharpest, youngest, most influential defensive mind as much as I am offensive mind.
What is it that those defensive minds would be doing differently? Because we have seen, obviously, the trend with all the people that have beards that are like Sean McVay that seem to get the most out of their quarterbacks on the offensive side of mm-hmm. things. What would it be for defense?
Well, you've seen at Iowa State what they did with some of their three-down and their three-down stack. Right, you've seen it, what Matt Rhule did at Baylor, taking that three-down stack defense, saying, yeah, but we're not just going to be sitting there and be sitting ducks. We're actually going to be aggressive in it and have a bunch of blitz packages off of it. It is going to be a little bit of Dave Aranda and what he does in the multiple looks that he's able to have with, I think, a bunch of defensive personnel that people thought, well, that's great. At LSU, you're just not going to have the kind of processors. You're going to have great athletes, but they're not going to be able to process, Dave, everything that you do and handle it. And he said, baloney. It's my job to simplify my complexity and get those guys to still just play just as fast and violent and be able to get out there and cover in one-on-one situations, be able to pattern read and route recognize and handle the things that you've got to handle in college football with a whole lot more space and a lot more wider fields than you have at the NFL level. I don't know. I just, outside the box thinking, why hasn't there been the same conversation about young, bright defensive minds that we are so quick to want on the offensive side of the ball?
Because offensive coaches are smarter.
Dude, watch your mouth.
You believe me. You're a quarterback. You cut, and your big quarterback
Jessamyn,
brain here.
Cut that sound and play it for Wyman later today, please.
I don't like a bloody workplace, so it's a good thing Danny's all the way in New York.
You would have never said that on the afternoon show, O'Neal.
I might have. We never know if Wyman was even paying attention. He'd all of a sudden go, what was Danny saying?
What'd you just say?
That is Blue 42. It's brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. Brock, honestly, though, I don't think I would ever hire a defensive coordinator from the SEC to do anything in the NFL because they're doing that with a surplus of talent. Like, what you're watching is basically like, hey, how can you use the best and fastest athletes in college football, and you're better and faster than other people? Like LSU's defense, that's not fair. Like the challenge in the NFL is like, okay, how do you stack up when your players are almost by design the same level of talent as the guys you're going against?
Until, Danny, you get true freshmen to play like seniors, like he did with a true freshman corner out there, right? Until you get those guys and you've got the Jim Thorpe Award winner on the back end and Delpit, who you asked to be a nickel and you asked to be a safety and you asked to be a linebacker, and you look at it and go, wow, there's a bunch of complexity in this scheme. And, you know, and a Dave Aranda that was at Wisconsin and he coached it, I believe, Utah State. He's been a bunch of different spots. He's not always had the goods, right, and the great groceries to work with. He's made it work with whatever he's had. And, you know, I think, honestly, it's not just, well, offensive guys are smarter. I think many times people say, well, all defense does is react to the offense, right? It's the offensive guys that set the personnel, they create the matchups, and then it's on the defense to try to react to that and try to match up. And but, you know, I think the brightest guys, and I think Venable's pretty good at Clemson. I think this Aranda is awesome. I think the kid at Wisconsin who played in the NFL a long time safety, Jim Leonard, I think he does a tremendous job. I just, you know, I study this NFL or this college tape, and 8 out of 10 of the defensive guys in college, you throw out and like, yep, you're just playing coverage. You're just playing base scheme. You're doing nothing with any ingenuity at all. And then you come across the Gary Pattersons, the Jim Leonards, the Dave Arandas. You're like, wow, how do these guys get their group to do this so well, into pattern read and to route recognize and to defensive check and to play multiple looks and have this kind of versatility and flexibility? To me, that would be very appealing if I'm an NFL guy looking to the college game.
You mentioned attacking a little bit more, and I think the best moment for the Seahawks defensively in Sunday's game was when they decided to send off the edge Shaquille Griffin, and they also had Shaquille Griffin doing some stunt to get through the middle.
Yes.
That's something I don't think we saw a lot of this season, Brock. Mm-mm. You would be, I think, more alert to seeing blitzes as they happen, but I don't remember the Seahawks blitzing a whole lot this season.
I don't know what their blitz numbers would look like. They would bring some of their linebacker dogs, right? You would see KJ or Bobby, or you would see Michael Kendricks at times. You would see some of the linebacker looks, but yeah, as far as just a creative, we're going to bring safeties, we're going to bring corners, we're going to bring exotic looks. That's just not really Pete's DNA. Because when you do that, it is hard to do what? It's hard to stay on top. It is hard to limit the big play, right? Feast or famine. I was sitting there watching that game last night with some football people and former football coaches, and it was kind of fun. Damon had a little get-together last night. And you remember they run a little screen, LSU did, for, I believe, a touchdown or a huge play, a little wide receiver screen. And I said, man, that play is such feast or famine. Danny, this is going to hurt, but it's what Oregon did on 4th and 3 against the Huskies, right? On that touchdown drive that really changed the game in the second half. They threw a little wide receiver screen to the short side of the field, and the tackle got out and blocked, and the Huskies had blitzed on that play, and it was the perfect call to beat that blitz, and you gave up a big play touchdown. And, you know, that feast or famine, that's not what Pete does. It's not what he believes in. That is not his philosophy at all. And yet, as he said to you guys in the presser yesterday, there has to be some change. There has to be, because this isn't, you know, a 6-game stretch. This isn't a 10-game stretch. This is over the last 2 seasons. where you look at their defensive numbers of takeaways, you look at their defensive numbers with sacks this year, you look at their defensive numbers in yards per play, and it just is not, you know, and really in the red zone the second half of the year. It's just not championship-level defense. And, Danny, what was your number in the first halves? 121 to 16?
Don't get it worked up.
What was it?
112.
112.
To 13.
112 to 13. Yeah, that's not championship-level play, and that's not championship-level defense.
Why does their offense not get going? And this is kind of the last, and there's no definite answer, because if we knew it, it'd be changed. Mm-hmm. Is it because the defense stops being aggressive, and that, so it's misleading? Like, they give up a ton of points because they're playing the clock as much as they're playing the opponent. Mm-hmm. Is it because Russell takes time to get going, and he takes time to recognize, and he has to wear down that, essentially he's got to build himself up and wear the opponent down to that position?
Okay.
Or is it that they stop running the offense that they're tethered to, and they'd be better off playing sandlot football from the beginning?
I'm going to give you three reasons why, and maybe we can continue to dig into this next tomorrow and over the offseason and everything else. I'll give you three reasons why. Number one, and these are all, I think, fairly real. Number one is Russell takes no risk. He is not going to give the ball away. So if it is not there and it is not clear, he'll take a sack. He'll throw it away. He is not going to take risk. His like risk tolerance and his governor is as strong as anybody to I think, ever play the game, honestly, at the NFL level. So he will not give you the ball. That's number one. Number two, they need to figure out how defenses are going to stop their run game. They are as committed to anybody as the run game, and people do tweak week to week what they're going to do. So we've got to figure out in the first 15 minutes through our scripts and our planning, how are they defending us? What are they going to do in their matchups? What is their defensive game plan? And then how do we adapt and grow from that? So I think those two are very, very real scenarios. And then, yeah, number three is after you've got that information, right? Pete calls it learning. Right, well, I've got to learn. Learners got to take in that information. I do think then they do adapt, and Russell becomes more aggressive, and I think they play off of what those defenses like to do. So, Danny, I think those are you know, three factors beyond, you know, just kind of some of the surface level stuff.
Brock, we always love it.
Love you guys.
We gave you four questions today. That wasn't really fair. We kind of packed it in there.
That's okay. That's okay. It's the off season. I can handle it. We're good.
We appreciate it.
All right.
Talk to you soon, Brock.
See you, bud.
That is Blue 42. It is brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. Paul tried to get to the bottom of this, and he went to a very good source. He went and talked to Russell Wilson to talk about the difference. And, well, they've got a who got mossed on Monday Night Football. This is our inaugural edition of Who Got Rust. And in cut number five, it's Paul Gallant.
What's the key to getting the offense jump-started more quickly than you know, what happened yesterday?
I think that's a whole season to look at and examine throughout the offseason, figure out what we can do better. I think it comes down to making plays. You know, I think it comes down to making sure that we put ourselves in the best position to make them, you know, and what we're trying to do and how we're trying to attack the defense. And then also it comes down to us as players ultimately making plays. You know, we got to find ways to do that. And so, you know, I always put things on me first. You know, is how can I get better to do that first, and then, and as a collective group, is there something else we could be doing? And so the reality is, you know, we had a really good season. We had a really, 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 really good season, and we were a few plays away from being really special. And the thing is that in this game, is it seems to be that you can be a few plays away to make yourself special. You can be a few plays from being almost special. And we got to make sure that we take that almost out of it and make sure that that's our only option is to win. And that's the only thing that we got to be focused on. This division is getting better, as you can see. NFC West has always been great. The 49ers are a good team. The Rams are going to be good again. The Cardinals are going to be better. And we got to make sure the Seattle Seahawks are better than the rest. And we got to find out how we're going to do that for years to come.
But Russ, the first half, how do you get better in the first half? I didn't get an answer to that anywhere, and I think I get it now, Danny. I think I get why some maybe are frustrated by answers that Russ gives. And look, you're entitled to give however answer you want to give.
You got to temper your expectations. You need to go in there expecting that it's going to be like a what do they call it when a vampire hypnotizes someone? There's a
entranced, enthralled.
No, there's it's
like Shining.
Glamored.
Yeah, there
you get
is.
Glamored. You get glamored. You got glamored. All of a sudden, Russ spits out a good minute's worth of cliches that don't really speak to anything other than the importance of plays being made and players making those plays.
And it's on me. 15 seconds into it, Danny, I was like, okay, well, now I understand that this was a pointless endeavor. I want to walk away and ask somebody else some questions. That's how I felt halfway through the answer, because I've heard these cliches before. You know, with Bill O'Brien, it was always, it's on me, when I would ask him a question if it was very pointed. And I was like, I get that it's on you, but I would like a little bit more out of it. Not the end of the world that you don't necessarily get it, but that's why I so much enjoyed his sit-down a couple of weeks ago with Tom, Jake, and Stacey. It felt different. It felt like he was not trying to give a political answer every single time he was asked a question. Because, yeah, we know the NFC West is good. Yeah, we know that there are also plays that need to be made, specifically in the first half where you're getting outscored. What's the number, Danny?
112-13.
Exactly. Make some plays then. How about that? How do you make those plays happen? That's the question I was asking, Russ.
It's so funny because I think, I don't know if I've ever seen an athlete who is as incredible spontaneously as Russell is as creative as Russell is, and yet is so regimented and rigid off the field. Like, it's a real contrast, because you would expect, and in my experience, most of those sort of freelance or athletes who are more akin to a jazz musician they are than to some like very rehearsed person kind of have a little bit of that free-form personality off the field as well, or off the court. And that's very much not the case. And Russell's got a very specific way that he approaches everything, and that includes interviews. And it's about being very predictable and getting himself. You can almost see him take any question, and instead of answering the question, he works his way back from the question to the talking points he wants himself to recite going out of it. So in that way, the interview is more for him than it is for anyone else. It's a challenge for him to get, how do I get this question and get it back to the talking points that I'm going to recite in my head that will help me perform better the next time this situation comes up.
I hope that works for him. I really do. But it has not worked for him in any of these first halves in divisional playoff games on the road.
What do you think it is? Do you think it's because that idea that it's on him? I mean, he's not responsible for the three and out series where they handed the ball to Marshawn Lynch three straight times. Is he being put in the best position to succeed early in the game? Is this a matter of him not taking enough risk? Is this a matter of him, or is this a matter of him being kind of bogged down or weighed down by an offense that doesn't accentuate his strengths?
That's a good question. Part of me, and you would know this better than me, part of me thinks that maybe he is a little bit too accepting of a game plan that is put in front of him. I mean, if you are someone, maybe not Tom Brady, but if you're Peyton Manning, and someone gave you a game plan, and the game plan called for not a whole lot of you early on, especially when you're in your prime, wouldn't you raise your hand and say, yeah, this is neat and all, but we all know that we need to get the passing game going early on when our running game is down to a guy that has not been the same running back that he was during the early days of the Legion of Boom. I mean, this is, we're talking about a running back that's 4 or 5 years removed from being the kind of guy that he used to be. Shouldn't we be operating differently, at least to open the game? I'm all for Marshawn Lynch maybe getting some carries later on if the passing attack has made the Packers defense a little bit nervous about getting beat deep. But when you're just handing it off to Marshawn and making it easy for them to load up and get a stop, that's just not helping yourself out.
This should be a fixable problem. The difficulties for first half offense in these situations should be a fixable problem, unless it's a matter of Russell wearing down the defense and having to get into the flow of the game, and there's just nothing you can do to accelerate that. If this is a matter of his risk, or it's a matter of play selection, this should be a fixable problem. You should be able, there's no reason that you have to wait until it gets desperate to be able to start moving the ball, because you can just transplant that urgency. You can just approach it as if you were trailing by 20. So I'm not sure the answer to that one. I do know that you should never, ever copy anything from the Cleveland Browns. Never. Yet I can't help but feeling the Seahawks should follow their lead in one regard. We'll explain what that is next.
Brock Heward, mornings at 8 with Danny and Gallant. Subscribe to receive the Brock and Salk podcast at Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or stream it through the 710 Sports app.
Well, my friends at Toyota Puyallup are starting 2020 with a bang. They've just announced super low 1.9% APR financing on many of their brand new 2020 models. You could choose the fuel-efficient Corolla or the stylish Camry, and you're going to pay just 1.9% APR. If you're looking for an SUV to handle these icy conditions or a work truck, well, the sporty RAV4 gas model or the rugged Toyota Tundra are also on sale, and you're going to pay that same, just 1.9% APR. The New Year Savings event is on right now with Carrie and her team at Toyota Puyallup. And remember, all new Toyotas come with Toyota Care. That is 2 years of complimentary maintenance. For the best car buying experience, look no further than Toyota Puyallup. Their long tenured staff will help answer all your questions, and they're going to find the perfect vehicle for your budget too. So go see Carrie, go see her team for all the New Year savings. It's Toyota Puyallup, putting you first since 1970. 1.9% APR up to 60 months on approval credit through TFS 150 to a doc fee may be added to the final sale or capitalized cost. Details at ToyotaPuyallup.com. Expires 1/31/20.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
When the Cleveland Browns do something, we generally laugh because, it doesn't tend to work out.
It's what about when they cleaned out their kitchens?
Well, okay. They brought in the kitchens. That's the problem.
Oh, that's true. They did install the kitchens, and then they pulled them out.
And then they hired the second runner-up to Freddie Kitchens this offseason. They hired Kevin Stefanski.
Let's run it back again.
Except for with our runner-up. Let's see how that goes. It has not worked out too well for the Browns, but they have tried some things differently from time to time. The let's outright tank and just try to get as many draft picks as possible strategy was certainly an interesting one. This time around with Kevin Stefanski, I'm very curious as to how things are going to go, but it does not sound very promising for old Kevy boy, as he now, at least per reports, is going to have to turn in a game plan to the owner and analytic department every single Friday, like it's a homework assignment. At the end of every single week, he's going to have to attend analytic meetings to discuss said game plan that he is supposedly turning into the owner and analytic department. And then on Monday, he's going to have to go to hours-long coach and owners meetings. Danny, I don't think that you believe that this is going to go successfully for this Stefanski guy. It seems like it's going to be a pain in the tuchus for him as well.
Yeah, I would say that it sounds like they've hired a deputy coach.
Yes.
Like they've got a junior deputy coach, and he is going to come in there, and he's not going to have the freedom to react to what he's seeing, which I think is a big part of play calling. I'm not against this idea, though.
I'm not either.
I'm not 100% against it, because I think if feedback from analytics, and by analytics, we should say what it means, because people now think it's using some sort of algorithm. It's people who will provide measurements of things that happen in a game to indicate tendencies. Like that's the best way to describe it, is people who take measurable data that occurs in games to reveal tendencies, to say you're best off in the long term if you take this approach because this team has this tendency. I think that can be a powerful tool. It requires two things. It requires a coach who's going to listen to that feedback, who's going to use it and react upon it. A good example would be John Harbaugh. The other thing is it requires a franchise that is going to have the guts to withstand negative consequences from those decisions. Because we know a couple of different things, and this is sort of from the social science field. It's something I'm fascinated in. We react with a power of 4x. We take losses 4 times as hard as we find victories satisfying. That's just our psychological makeup. And what that means is that every time that analytics pushes or advises something that would be counterintuitive or against what you would usually do, every time it fails, that failure is going to feel 4 times as strong as the times that it succeeds. This is for years why they didn't use infield shifts. It looks really bad when it doesn't work. I'm curious to see how John Harbaugh reacts. He had 2 fourth down decisions that the numbers said, the tendency said, it's advantageous to go for it. The Ravens got stopped on both of them. And that is going to be used to bend around. Oh, you trusted the numbers there. And the point of analytics is not that it will always work. It's to give you what is the best long-term play in those sort of situations. So you need a strong franchise that will say, we trust the process, even when we're getting killed in the short term because a result didn't pan out. And the second thing is you have to have a coach that's willing to listen and implement it. I don't think this is necessarily the best setup for it, but I like the idea.
Stefanski definitely has to listen to it. He has no choice but to. He is being forced into this.
I know. And it's kind of like that person that takes a job where, like, you know what you're getting into here, and it's like, I'd rather I'll take the job, fine. I'll do it. It's not my ideal situation, but I don't know if I'm going to be a head coach again. I'm 37 years old, and I'm going to make a lot of money even if this goes to hell. So I'll just – fine, I'll do it. I'll take it. I'll submit a game plan in advance, and you can do it.
At first glance, it does seem like it would be the absolute worst to go through as a head coach. But the more I think about it, the more I think that this could actually be beneficial for Stefanski. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of pressure on him. There's more pressure on him to just do what these guys are asking him to do outside the box, and that might mean more time away from his family, more time sleeping in the office. But I think the idea of having an analytic guy with a headset that has access to the coaching staff is NFL progress. And we'll see how it pans out. I think the biggest problem, Danny, you're going to need to find someone who has the ability to translate these numbers, that these tendencies, into a way that these football coaches can digest them and understand them and not be like, shut up, nerd, because there are going to be coaches that do that. I was watching the Bill Belichick and Nick Saban HBO documentary this weekend, and there was a spot where Belichick and Saban, who we both know are probably two of the most forward-thinking coaches in the history of the game, they even showed a little bit of reluctance towards numbers and analytics.
Flat out mocked it. It said, no, the reason we lost this game is because we didn't block and tackle. It wasn't because of the third down packages that we ran against. Like, they're sneering at it because it goes against, it asks a coach to operate in a fundamentally different way, which isn't how do I get the most out of my players? How do I maximize? It asks you to make decisions that you think over hundreds of repetitions will play out the best, as opposed to, how do I make the most out of this one moment right now and put everything I have on it?
What you need out of a coach, if you're the Browns, is a leader. You don't need somebody that's more willing to, I think, listen to all of these different things that kind of question how you're going about teaching these young players and teaching these old players how to maximize their performance. But I feel like these coaches should be a little bit more willing to allow something like this in their lives. Let's throw out all of the idea of what plays you call in specific situations. Just having an analytic slash number guy with you for game management situations is a no-brainer. To have somebody who can tell you, you know what, you're probably going to have X amount of time if we call a timeout here, or X amount of time, you have X amount of the ability to overturn this call if you throw it out there. I think it would be massive. Now, it might slow down the process of how a coach breaks down information, and it might be overwhelming for a lot of coaches out there because there's a lot going on the sideline. I think we sometimes put a little bit we're a little bit unfair with how we think that coaches operate on the sideline. But I am curious to see how this works out, and I would like to see more teams try to do something like this. What's the harm in having some guy that knows numbers and can actually explain them to a coach on the sideline?
There's no harm in it. There's no guarantee that you're going to listen to him, though. Pete Carroll had for a long time, Carl Smith was what the guy he trusted for replay reviews. And Pete's fairly bad at replay challenges. And one of the reasons is because he wouldn't, the guidelines is that Tater would tell him, and that was Carl Smith's nickname, Tater would tell him, we've got a view of that, I think you can win it. Or he'd say, there's no view, there's nothing I've seen yet. And he would basically indicate, have I seen something that indicates you'll win this challenge? That was his job. And half the time on those challenges, Tater hadn't said anything of the sort. He told him, like, hey, we don't have it. And Pete's like, well, forget it, I'm throwing it.
Fatal optimism, baby.
I feel that strong about it. So that's the other part, is that there's no guarantee that the football coach is going to follow any of that advice or heed any of it. And in fact, think about the times in baseball that it's happened. Like Mike Scioscia and Jerry DePoto, like Scioscia wouldn't implement or use any of the information that DePoto's front office was giving to him. That's what the reports out of it. And they always publicly said, hey, get along, got a lot of respect. They won a World Series together. But ultimately, they stopped working together. And that's baseball. That's what, I mean, the manager's impact on the day-to-day or the pitch-to-pitch of a game is minimal. Like, a football coach is incredibly important to that.
It's Danny and Gallant, Danny O'Neill, Paul Gallant. Coming up next, Danny owes Michael Bennett an apology, and it has nothing to do with football. It has to do with the biggest story in sports yesterday. We'll explain next. Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
All right, Paul. I honestly thought it was one of the funniest things I'd ever heard when I heard it, the recording of this. When Michael Bennett asserted that one Jim Moore, Cougs Go, should be fired and suspended, I thought it was the funniest thing that I'd ever heard.
You should be fired and suspended.
Get it with both barrels. Come on, fired and suspended. I was like, one kind of makes the other irrelevant, doesn't it?
It does. Like,
and then I realized that I owe an apology to Michael Bennett because it can happen. And in fact, it did yesterday. AJ Hinch and Jeff Luna of the Houston Astros got suspended and then fired. They were fired and suspended on the same day.
Fired and suspended.
It's true. And it's shocking. I can't believe that we're finally seeing an owner levy more punishments on two people that have been punished in a very significant way by a sports league.
But at the same time, this is one of the, I don't want to say it's a slap on the wrist because two guys lost their jobs. And Houston will have to forfeit some draft picks. A first and second round pick in two different years. They're going to forfeit a total of four draft picks. They're going to pay $5 million for an orchestrated sign-stealing system, which included live video being piped into the tunnel behind their clubhouse. And then guys, in a super-secret fashion, slamming a bat or something against a trash can to indicate when an off-speed pitch was coming.
Need more trash can.
Yeah, they hit a trash can, which made me wonder a couple things. First of all, I thought that the better punishment would be just say, okay, the Astros can't use the DH for 2 years. Second best would be, like, maybe you make them wear hats that say the trash tros, like with a big garbage can on the front of it, like a scarlet letter. You've got to wear that for 2 years as like a badge of shame. I all thought these were better. Or when you suspend Hinch and Luna, force them, like, you've got to spend every game in a trash can for those 3 hours. And at any point during the game, the opponent can decide to go over and slam the side of the trash can with something hard and heavy. Like you have to be treated like Oscar the Grouch, basically, and tortured and tormented during that time. I thought all of those would have been acceptable. But here's the problem, that this is a punishment that is designed to eliminate future questions. This is not a punishment that's about actually finding out what happened, actually determining how pervasive it is. This is an attempt to get this to go away without talking about it more. This is exactly like what the NBA did with Tim Donaghy, which is to say something was happening that undermines the actual competitive integrity of our league. And we're not actually going to get to the bottom of it. We're just going to tell you, hey, it wasn't as bad as it seemed, and we've taken care of all the rascals that were doing it.
And by the way, I think it's more bad than it seems, because I know that the Astros have definitely taken this to extreme levels, because, of course, they brought trash cans into the equation. But the Boston Red Sox did something like this, and we're going to find out how punished manager Alex Cora will be. It sounds like he will get a more significant punishment than both A.J. Hinch and Jeff Luno. What that means, I don't know. Is that a lifetime ban?
That's bad for Alex Cora. It doesn't hurt the team at all. And unless you're related to Alex Cora, or unless, like, you believe, how much does firing a manager hurt? It doesn't hurt a team's ability to compete. It hurts him. He's not going to be able to earn anymore, and it's going to impact him. Like, the Red Sox, is their season win differential going to go down? Like, they're going to lose 20 more games because they know it's like negligible.
Right. As far as the three major sports leagues go, I would say that a baseball manager has the least impact on his team, though basketball coaches are trending in that direction as well, towards that of a baseball manager. But you're right. Getting rid of Cora doesn't do a whole lot. I do think you're somewhat underselling the idea of what losing your first and second round draft picks 2 years in a row can do. That, I think, is a problem. I think that does hurt you a bit. but it doesn't hurt you that much. It doesn't take away from the championship.
7 years down the road, right? That's when it's going to impact you.
Right, exactly. But when it will hit you, it will hit you. And for a team like the Astros that doesn't have the kind of money like the Yankees or the Red Sox, that will hurt at some point. But the idea that it's just the Astros or the idea that it's just the Astros and the Red Sox is baloney. And whether it's players that have come out and said, yeah, this is a little bit more pervasive. The Yankees and Dodgers are doing this stuff too. They are. I've talked to one person who has suggested it. I have also heard from others who have suggested it. This is an across baseball problem. And leave it to baseball with their weenie commissioners to basically sit idly by with their hands in their ears singing la 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 while a major problem is honestly hurting the sport. And if this is getting to a point where you are seeing what you saw in the 2017 World Series, where both teams were so paranoid of sign stealing that the game took like 4.5 hours, 5 hours for game seven, which again, it's game seven. You'll love it. This is a problem that every single team feels is happening, that other teams are using nefarious methods to steal their signs.
Should we go to an earpiece method where a pitcher can just cover his mouth with his glove and talk to a little earpiece?
A little Bluetooth?
Like there'll be special ops guys who have it like strapped around their throat to be able to see it. I want to, if everybody's cheating, is it cheating? If everybody's breaking the rules, is
it
cheating?
Gamesmanship.
If everybody's cheating, is it cheating? And the second part is that our idea of punishments in sports are really misguided because we think that the punishment is a search for justice. In modern sports, it is not. It is about corporate butt covering. It is about somebody in an office in New York deciding on what's the way that we can solve this with doing the least damage to our actual product and reputation. Like, that's entirely what it is. It is not about justice. It is not about fairness. And it is not about really even about punishing the wrongdoers. It's about protecting the profits of a bunch of stuffed shirts.
In the NFL, in the Spygate scandal, a lot of people would argue that that's exactly what happened because they didn't release the tapes to the public. They destroyed the tapes. Now, I'd argue that the advantage that those tapes could have actually given the Patriots during games is a lot more minimal than what we could see maybe today because they were on VHS and you got to like move things around the stadium and all that. But I understand like why people are like, why aren't we seeing the tapes? Why aren't we seeing how many of these tapes there were? And to just say, okay, this is over. This is done. This is gone forever. That is not an effective strategy because teams are going to continue to do stuff like this. And I think with baseball, like they have proven that they are just way too slow on the trigger finger when it comes to doing anything about these problems that affect their sport. We saw it with Bud Selig and steroids, and we're seeing it right now with Rob Manfred and this. And, okay, cool. Alex Cora, gone for the year. Okay, cool. A.J. Hinch, Jeff Luno, fired. Is that going to stop the Yankees or Dodgers or the Red Sox?
Do you think it'll stop it? That's the first question. The second thing is it fair? Is that a just punishment? Like, is that what those guys deserve for clearly breaking the rules? And then the final question is, okay, what does it accomplish? We're always going to look at the Astros differently with their World Series win.
That's all because, it accomplishes.
Yeah, we will. And that's fine. They deserve that. But the idea that all of a sudden that this sent a message that cheating will not be tolerated. No, this sent a message that if you embarrass the league and create videos that people on Twitter can replay counting the number of trash can strikes, that you're going to be hung out to dry because you've gotten in the way. You're potentially endangering everybody's trip to the trough now.
Yeah, and honestly, you might be endangering the whole league. I mean, imagine if this isn't league-wide scandal. Well, what happens then? I suppose it doesn't look that bad because the entire league's doing it and this cheating scandal wasn't that big of a deal. But when you're punishing people like this, it was a big deal at one point. It's a weird back and forth. Baseball, man. I just constantly feel like of all the leagues, they're the one that is the slowest to adapt and they're the one that is the worst at really biting issues in the butt.
Hockey might be slower.
Hockey slower. That's true. And look, this is something that we're going to find out a whole lot about when a Seattle hockey team comes here next year.
You can't steal signs in hockey, though. You're like, hey, that guy's going to try and fling the puck inside. Hey, we're going to go in the trap. You just skate around, right, Lydia?
Yeah, that doesn't really exist. They've just started incorporating more analytics into their game plan because it's just, as you mentioned, like some coaches and some organizations weren't even buying into that until recently.
It's Danny and Gallant. Coming up next, what's the reason Seattle didn't get farther this season? Was it injuries? Was it talent? Or was it scheme? We'll dive back into that conversation next.